Congress, how the president can hold not only President Trump accountable, but other Republicans, and as you say, this is often bipartisan, Democrats as well, on the critical issues that you care about. And this whole issue that isn't being talked about as much, especially as Republicans try to frame what's happening here in New York as the DA saying he won't go after misdemeanor crimes, as not going after serious crime, but instead using this political target of Trump. In other words, but instead going after corporate crime. If you can talk about how novel this is for people to see issues of corporate crime front and center.
Well, I wish they would use the phrase corporate crime more instead of the antiquated white-collar crime. We're in the corporate crime wave in this country. All you got to do is read the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, listen to Democracy Now. And the amount of enforcement budget is minuscule. It's like having 20 police in Manhattan during the crime wave. And so you're right to point out Congress is the focal point here. Whether we like it or not, it is the most accessible branch of government. There are 535 men and women. People know their names back home, and they've got to get mobilized, because what Congress can do is redress the imbalance of power, rein in empire, rein in the military budget, redirect public budgets to public necessities in this country, and above all, initiate its criminal contempt power. This idea that congressional subpoenas of the White House can be defied with impunity because it takes too long for Congress to work through the federal courts up to the Supreme Court is a false idea, because the Congress has generic criminal contempt power. They can arrest. They could have arrested Trump when he defied the January 6th subpoena. They could have detained them. That actually occurred in the 1930s. But a lot of members of Congress don't even know that they have the criminal contempt power and do not have to go to 4 years of judicial appeals, etc. So Congress is the hope for the American people. It's the hope to redress this. It's the hope to reorder our priorities. It's the hope to really make sure that nobody is above the law at high political and corporate crime levels. Corporation CEOs are clearly, in many ways, completely above the law. Look at the Boeing criminality. There's been no action against Muhlenberg and the other CEO, the present CEO now of Boeing. They got away with it. And people all over the country know that the big boys get away with it. There's a double standard of justice. So people out there, get on top of your senators and representatives. Show them you've got a pulse. You know their numbers. You know their emails. You know how to reach them. Without you, Congress can't act. Without Congress, we don't have a republic. We have an emerging fascist movement in this country, and Trump proved it by his words yesterday at Mar-a-Lago.
Ralph Nader, I want to thank you for being with us, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate. He's the founder of the Capitol Hill Citizen, which is coming out in a few weeks, a newspaper, and also the grand uncle of Samia Stumo, who lost her life in the Boeing crash in Ethiopia. Coming up, we look at major progressive victories from Chicago to Wisconsin. Stay with us.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. And I know it's gonna be a lovely day. When the day that lies ahead of me
crucible of faith.
Lovely Day by Bill Withers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. While Donald Trump's arraignment and arrest dominated headlines Tuesday, two significant elections took place in Chicago and Wisconsin. We'll look at both, beginning in Wisconsin, where Judge Janet Protasiewicz has won a special election over Dan Kelly for a seat on the state Supreme Court, giving progressives control of the court for the first time in 15 years. With her election, the court's now expected to restore abortion rights in Wisconsin. Janet Protasiewicz spoke to supporters Tuesday night.
Today's results mean two very important and special things.
Yes.
First, it means that Wisconsin voters have made their voices heard.
Yes. Yes.
They've chosen to reject partisan extremism in this state.
Yes.
And second, it means our democracy will always prevail.
Yes.
Too many have tried to overturn the will of the people.
Yep.
Today's results show that Wisconsinites believe in democracy and the democratic process.
Yeah.
Joining us from Wisconsin right now, from Madison, John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent. His new piece is headlined, Wisconsin Chooses a Progressive Justice in the Most Important Election of 2023. I assume you're up very late writing this, John. Judge Janet Protasiewicz. We have to keep on practicing that. It is not an easy name to say, but it's one that could determine how the 2024 national elections turn out. Explain the significance of this race.
It's hard to overestimate the significance of the race, Amy, and thanks for having me on. Look, the Wisconsin Supreme Court was really the bulwark of conservative political and legislative action in the state for more than a decade, going back to the days of Scott Walker. It was the Wisconsin Supreme Court that put a stamp of approval on Walker's assaults on labor unions, on Walker's assaults on voting rights, and a host of other issues, and including on that list the gerrymandering of Wisconsin's legislative and congressional district maps. So right there, having a new liberal majority on the court opens up the possibility that the maps for legislative districts and congressional districts will be redrawn. That redraw, if it comes quickly enough, could open up as many as two congressional seats for competitive elections that are not now possible. That, in turn, means that Democrats could pick up two House seats in Wisconsin. If you think about how narrowly the U.S. House of Representatives is currently divided, that's a very significant development right there. But the other thing that's very significant as regards the 2024 election is that the Wisconsin Supreme Court, to a greater extent than almost any court in the country, has entertained many of the Republican efforts to assault voting rights, suppress votes, alter ways in which elections are managed and handled. This court came within a vote of really opening the door for many of Trump's challenges to the 2020 election results. And the conservative candidate in this race, Dan Kelly, was a lawyer for the Republican Party who actually engaged in and was part of those discussions about developing a slate of fake electors which would have sought to overturn the election. If he had won a place on this court in 2024, if Donald Trump was the presidential candidate of the Republican Party, if he was challenging results, he would have had a court in Wisconsin that was particularly sympathetic to him. Now he has a court, as Janet Protasiewicz said, that is determined to uphold the rule of law and to defend democracy. So that in itself, not just for Wisconsin, but for the whole country, is a huge shift.
And John, could you talk about how this victory became possible, given the fact that judicial elections are normally not high-profile events that most voters pay attention to?
Yes, that is a very good question, Juan. Look, in Wisconsin, judicial elections have become high-profile events in recent years. Going back to 2018, when Justice Rebecca Dallet won a critical race for the Supreme Court. And in 2020, when Justice Jill Karofsky defeated Dan Kelly, the conservative running this year, in a Supreme Court race. And so these races have become more and more significant in Wisconsin. This one, because it was a balance tipping race, became a big deal. People recognized that a seat became open. That's when a former justice or current justice decided not to run for re-election. That was a conservative justice. This open seat, it became clear, was going to determine whether this was going to be a conservative court or a liberal court going forward, not just for the next few years, but potentially into the 2030s, because these are 10-year terms on the court. So a lot of progressives in Wisconsin began to focus very, very closely on this race. They made a big deal about it. They talked about it early. They organized a great deal. You saw labor groups, civil rights groups, community groups, all sorts of folks, you know, who really got engaged with this, not this year, but they started last year. And the fact of the matter was the race did become nationalized. You saw huge amounts of conservative money coming in from billionaire donors. And at the end of the day, it looks like there's going to be about $45 to $50 million spent on this race, the most expensive Supreme Court race in the history of the United States. So all of that made it incredibly high profile, to the point where you saw kind of breakthroughs in turnout, much higher turnout in a lot of the state than in previous races by far.
And John, we have another two cities to go to in today's show, because so much is happening from Chicago to Nashville. Nashville is about guns. Abortion, I think, is one of the key issues in this race. The abortion law in effect now, the abortion ban, was passed in 1849, an abortion ban in Wisconsin. Would you say this is a bellwether overturning, I mean, putting in a progressive majority on what this could mean for the country?
Absolutely, on the issue of reproductive rights. And Janet Protasiewicz, as a candidate, said from the start that she would speak about her values. And one of her values was that she believed that the right to choose was settled law, and that women have a right to make choices as regards their own bodies. She was very blunt about that. Her opponent, Dan Kelly, was backed by militant anti-abortion groups. And so it was an incredibly clear choice. And in a battleground state, one of the most contested states in the country, you now have a potential that a liberal Supreme Court may overturn that 1849 law, a law passed just 1 year after Wisconsin became a state. If it does, this could be one of the real breakthroughs as regards the debate over reproductive rights, but also for this understanding that this issue of a woman's right to choose is an incredibly potent political issue. There is simply no question that it resonated in the race in Wisconsin, and it was one of the factors that drew a tremendous number of young voters, especially students on campuses, to the polls. And they played a very critical role in this contest, both in the primary and the general election.
Well, we want to thank you, John, for being with us. John Nichols, Nation's national affairs correspondent, speaking to us from Madison, Wisconsin. We'll link to your piece, Wisconsin Chooses a Progressive Justice in the Most Important Election of the Year. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we go from Wisconsin to Chicago, another closely watched race, Brandon Johnson was elected mayor of Chicago in a major victory for progressives. Johnson, a Black teachers union organizer, defeated conservative Democrat Paul Vallas, a champion of charter schools who ran on a law and order platform. Johnson won even though Vallas had outspent him 2-1. Brandon Johnson spoke last night to supporters.
So Chicago, I'll say it this day. Today, we take big steps towards figuring it out here. So I believe since we are taking steps to figure it out here, let's take this bold progressive movement around these United States of America.
So, Juan, that's Brandon Johnson. You're in Chicago. Talk about the significance of this victory.
Yes, Amy. All the polls have been predicting a dead heat. It was a close race, the narrowest margin since Harold Washington won election as Chicago mayor back in 1983. But Brandon Johnson did succeed in rebuilding a progressive coalition to be able to capture the the mayoralty. He won in impressive majorities in various groups across the city. In the African-American community, he did far better than the polls were showing. So basically, the undecided African-American voters broke in the last week almost completely for him. He did win a majority of the Latino wards of the city. At the same time, Paul Vallas did do very well in some other Latino wards in this city, in the areas of Humboldt Park, Westtown, Logan Square, Avondale, the historically Puerto Rican neighborhoods of the north side of Chicago. Brandon Johnson racked up in the almost 70% of the vote. But in some of the more middle class Latino neighborhoods of the southwest Chicago, actually, Paul Vallas had the majority of the vote. So Brandon Johnson did win a significant majority among the Latino community, which, of course, has been the fastest growing. But Vallas did have significant support, obviously, in the white community and in some sections of the Latino community as well. Now comes the difficult part of governance, because Brandon Johnson is going to be facing a police department, police officers who see him as their worst nightmare. He's going to be facing a business community that is definitely worried about some of his pronounced policy positions, and of course, the billionaires who continue to fund the charter school movement are going to be find a difficult situation with the new mayor. So we're going to be a key aspect of this, of course, was the power and the mobilization and the money of major labor unions like the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, the Teachers Union, especially the Chicago Teachers Union. Those were the main bulwarks of the ground organization that Brandon Johnson was able to put together, as well as the financing that he was able to raise.
Well, of course, we'll continue to follow what happens in Chicago with you right there in the middle of everything, Juan. Next up, we're going to go to Tennessee, where Republicans are trying to expel three Democratic lawmakers for supporting student-led gun control protests at the state capitol after last week's school shooting in Nashville. We'll speak with one of the legislators they're trying to expel. Stay with us. To Love by the Blues Brothers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Students across the United States today are joining a nationwide school walkout to demand lawmakers take action on gun control just over a week after a mass shooting at a Nashville elementary school killed six people, including three nine-year-olds. Gun violence remains the leading cause of death in young people in the United States. The tragic attack prompted multiple student-led mass protests that filled the plaza outside Tennessee's state capitol building, as well as the halls inside the Capitol. Among those who joined them were three Democratic state lawmakers. Now, Tennessee House Republicans are taking steps to expel the three. For more, we're joined in Nashville by one of the targets of the Republicans. Democratic Tennessee State Representative Justin Jones faces an expulsion vote Thursday, along with Representatives Gloria Johnson and Justin Pearson. They've already been stripped from committee assignments and their member IDs have been shut off. And we're joined by Esri Tyler, a national organizer for March for Our Lives and a student now at Vanderbilt University. She was 13 years old when she organized her first walkout after the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Esri, talk about the—I mean, there is not that much attention on what's going on in Nashville right now after this mass shooting killed six. But over 1,000 people protested at the state capitol on one day alone. Talk about what you're demanding.
Absolutely. We're demanding that lawmakers hear that we can't be ignored anymore. This issue has been, as you said, it's the leading cause of death for young people across the nation. But Tennessee is uniquely impacted by this. We have some of the loosest gun control laws in the entire nation and some of the highest death rates of gun violence. And it means that it's an issue that impacts us every day. And the Covenant School shooting is a tragic reminder that this is something that impacts our young people every single day. So thousands of students turned out on Monday, and in a coalition of teachers, students, elected officials from the level of school board levels all the way to state representatives showed out with us. And it shows that we are not alone in wanting this change, and we are demanding this change. And the expulsion is just an attempt to silence our voices.
And what's been the responses of teachers and other school officials to the walkouts?
Teachers and other school officials have been completely supportive. In fact, we actually had a Metro Nashville Public Schools board member join us and speak at the rally with us. They are here with us. Teachers are equally fed up. And the reason that we had these walkouts is because our schools aren't a safe place for our students, and we need to acknowledge that.
Esri, you said you're protesting also the attempted expulsions tomorrow, which brings us to our next guest, to Representative Justin Jones. Can you please explain how this is possible? You were elected by the people. You're one of the youngest representatives in the Tennessee state legislature. And now the Republicans are attempting not only to strip you of your committee assignments, which you already have been stripped of, but to throw you out? Why? What took place on the state legislature floor?
Yes. Well, thank you, Amy. I think it is so morally insane that a week after a mass shooting traumatized our community, instead of passing laws to take these weapons of war off our streets, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are passing a resolution and pushing a resolution to expel us for being voices of opposition. This is authoritarianism. This is an assault on our democracy. It's an attempt to silence the voices of thousands who gathered, students, mothers, grandparents, teachers, people who are demanding action to stop our children being massacred in schools. This is a preventable issue, and our colleagues are trying to bury us because they want to shift attention from the children we had to bury, the nine-year-olds in our community that is still grieving. And so what happened is that our colleagues, we stood with these students, we stood with the young people, we stood with those gathered in the state house because that is our job as lawmakers, is to make sure that the voice of the people are heard. And the speaker cut off our microphones. He wouldn't let us talk about the issue of gun violence on the House floor. And so we stood up in the well and chanted with the people in the galleries and let them know that we need action, that until we take action, there will be no peace in our community. That Nashville, this is not the first mass shooting in Nashville. There's one of my constituents with the Waffle House shooting was impacted by the Waffle House mass shooting. And unless we take action, this will not be the last mass shooting in Nashville. This is a crisis that we need to address. And so we're facing a crisis of mass shootings, and now we're facing a crisis of our democracy, where colleagues on the other side of the aisle are openly welcoming and signaling a system that's nothing less than fascism, to oust three democratically elected lawmakers and to silence over 200,000 voters in our state is a danger to democracy all across this nation.
And Representative Jones, they actually shut off your ID card access, removed you from being able to access the parking lots of the legislature, and also removed you from committees. Was this done by a vote, or was this done just by fiat by the leadership?
It was done by the Speaker, Cameron Sexton, who is acting like an autocrat. I mean, what we saw was no due process. We got a notification to kick us off committee, to limit our access in the building. But what we want to say is that it's not about us. It's about that what they're doing is they're limiting the movement. They're limiting what we represent. And what we're seeing is opposition voices being kicked out of the legislature by a supermajority Republican body that is drunk with power and that is trying to silence any voice of dissent in our state. Our state constitution, Article 2, Section 27, says that lawmakers lawmakers have a right to dissent from and protest against legislation that is injurious to the people. This proliferation of guns, of weapons of war on our streets is injurious to the people. We had no other choice but to do our job and to speak and dissent and protest against this immoral obedience and worship of guns in our state. And we will continue to do that, whether we are expelled or not. We will continue to stand with the people, because that's what we should do.
Representative Jones, I want to play a clip of you last month. This is on the legislature floor. After the passing of House Bill 30, which seeks to expand banning drag shows in public spaces.
I just want to point our attention to some hypocrisy that's happening in this building right now. So we just voted to not have any type of regulation or any type of safety precautions around the Second Amendment, but now we have a bill to regulate drag shows. Drag shows are not a threat to our community. Mass shootings are. So I hope that we pay attention to the ridiculousness, the circus that is this body, where we're now passing a bill to create a regulatory board of drag shows. But the sponsor of the previous bill said that we should not regulate the Second Amendment. But when it comes to the First Amendment, members of this body have every intention and every comfort with disrespecting, undermining, and regulating First Amendment's free expression clause. I just think it's absurd that we are so threatened by drag shows, but we don't take seriously the real threats to our community. And I just ask my colleagues here again to look in the mirror. What is going on in this body? This is absurd. And I hope that the sponsor of this bill will reconsider this attack on the LGBTQ community.
Banning drag shows, but not guns. Representative Jones, you also had an interaction with one of your Republican colleagues where he attacked you on the floor, grabbed your phone, and slammed it on the ground?
Yeah, on Monday, when they first introduced this resolution to expel, they cleared the gallery. I know Esri was up there with students. The media was kicked out of the gallery. And so I was trying to record what was going on. They sent troopers to descend on the gallery and to remove people from their house. And as I was recording, Representative Justin Lafferty pushed me and grabbed my phone. And so he acted in a way that was disorderly and in a way that was instigating violence, but we don't see any motion to expel him. But they're expelling us because we stood with the people. They're expelling us because we called attention to their proliferation of guns and weapons of war on our streets. They're expelling us because they don't want to talk about the issue. And they think that by getting rid of us, that the issue will go away. But we know that it will not, that the people will continue to show up and hold them accountable and say that we must protect our kids and not protect guns, that our communities are more important than money from the NRA. And that's what we're saying.
I'd like to bring Esri Tyler back to the conversation. There's a national school walkout today or Wednesday as students continue to demand that lawmakers enact stricter gun control laws. Is it your sense that given the inability of grown adults and politicians to be able to do something about gun violence, that it will necessitate a continued disruptions of the public school system by high school students walking out to force change in our government policies?
High school students have been walking out for years now to demand change in this issue. I started in this movement 5 years ago when we began with the tragic Parkland shooting at 13 years old, where I felt like it was my responsibility to walk out of my middle school. Mm-hmm. And we have continued to be showing out and continued to show up. And the nationwide walkouts are in support of the Nashville walkouts that we saw on Monday, which were a huge show that all of these coalitions are in unity on this. But the biggest thing with these nationwide walkouts is that they're drawing attention to the fact that there is not only inaction, but there is flagrant disgrace and disregard for students and the continued organizing. And that is why we are also needing to expand and discuss the fact that gun violence is an inherently intersectional issue. And by censoring our representatives and the representation of those who are protesting with us, it is even more disrespectful to the youth vote. Youth voters are consistently turning out in record numbers, and we are who are deciding the policies. We saw even in these last midterms, the youth is what decided who was elected and what is coming next. And so to these lawmakers who think that they can continue to ignore us and who can continue to ignore us on the nationwide scale, they're going to feel the price. Because if they continue to try to not pay attention to young people, they are going to be voted out.
Esri Tyler, you're at Vanderbilt. Justin Jones, you were at Vanderbilt. Justin Jones, What is your recourse to stop this from happening? The response of your constituents who voted you in, and also you and your colleague are the youngest black representatives in the Tennessee State House. Is that right? Yeah. You're also joined by a white female representative who they're trying to throw out.
Yeah, that's correct. So myself and Representative Pearson are the youngest black representatives.
You're listening to